Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. This is part two of our discussion with Dr. Tim Spector. He's the author of a great new book called The Diet Myth, Why the Secret to Health and Weight Loss is Already in Your Gut. Dr. Tim Spector is a professor of genetic epidemiology at King's College in London, and he is well known for his research on twins. We'll talk a little bit about that and the importance of studying twins from the standpoint of nature versus nurture. He's also an expert on the microbiome. And in fact, he launched something called the British Gut Project. We'll learn more about that in this part two of today's discussion. So, Dr. Spector, some interesting tidbits in the book. Cheese as a health food? Yeah, you know, it's laden with saturated fat, and a lot of people claim they're allergic to dairy. Many diets suggest that you get off dairy products. What's your take on that?
Well, I think this is our British-American slant on cheese. The French eat twice as much cheese as the Brits, and they have less heart disease and live longer. And we've had this idea that cheese was bad for us because it contains saturated fat. And a lot of the content of these cheeses, particularly the tasty soft cheeses, are very high in fat. But the data has never convincingly shown that cheese is bad for you. And all the epidemiology that I was able to find pointed out that regular cheese eaters actually had less heart disease than people who avoided cheese. So I think this is another of these myths that doctors faced with a patient with high blood pressure just instantly said, oh, well, you've got to stop eating cheese or have low-fat cheese or dairy products because of this misinformation about the whole process. And cheese may, you know, whether the fat or is actually as bad as people say, when I think we can discuss that later, but cheese is a, people forget, is actually a living substance. And in a few crumbs of cheese, there are billions of live microbes.
Mm-hmm. That is, unless you get pasteurized cheese, you know, you get Kraft, you know, cheese slices. You know, you're from the UK, but presumably it's the same over there. You go to a supermarket here and you get these, you know, orange rectangles that are bereft of any living organisms, obviously.
Yeah, no, I think nowhere is as bad as the U.S. for its sterile cheese.
So right.
I think that's one import we didn't take, but we still have, yeah, we do, a lot of the frozen processed cheese that goes on cheap pizzas and things is exactly the same. It's totally sterile. It's mm-hmm. dead. Mm-hmm. It just has a gluey substance. That's it. So I'm talking about real cheese here, and testing real cheese, you find that it's full of microbes, and even pasteurized cheese still has billions of microbes in it, although unpasteurized cheese has more. So it's virtually impossible to get unpasteurized cheese in the U.S. In any large quantities because of the strict law worrying about food outbreaks more than gut health. But it's in Europe. It's routine and increasingly common. There are now hundreds of manufacturers of unpasteurized British cheese, for example. Mm-hmm. We worry about it much less. But so the idea is that it's acting like a probiotic, and in the same way as yogurt, essentially, these different microbes. And when you have a blue cheese, people often don't realize they're actually eating fungus.
Wow.
That bit in the Stilton or the Roquefort, it's a mixture of these fungi, which the bacteria also like to play around, and this community that you're eating. So, again, that's one reason why I think people should reintroduce eating real cheese, traditional artisan cheese, into their diets. And all the epidemiology in the past, particularly from the 80s, things like the China study, really don't hold up to scrutiny when you start looking at the actual data and trial data in humans, of which there's very little, but everything pointing towards it actually being beneficial, not harmful.
So there's a lot.
there's a lot that's been written lately about the health benefits of coffee all of a sudden. And you shared in your book a fact that I was not cognizant of, which is that coffee actually may be a source of fiber and beneficial polyphenols that may help to promote a healthy microbiome. Tell us about that.
Yeah, and it was a surprise to me as well. So this is one of the good things about writing a book. You can find lots of facts that change your mind on things. I was telling my patients, don't drink too much coffee, tea's better for you. And it turns out, you know, I was wrong, and that looking at the big studies now coming out of epidemiology showing that actually regular coffee drinkers have less heart disease than non-drinkers. And it is partly the fiber in the bean, but it's also these polyphenol chemicals that are given off in large amounts, that you get much more polyphenols, which feed the microbes in your colon than you'd expect, and much more than you get from black tea. So that's not good for the British tea drinkers. They got very upset when they heard this.
Right.
But green tea is quite good as well. So just by the way you sort of prepare the leaves can make a big difference to the polyphenols. So green tea is another source as well as the coffee. But the coffee story is a bit like the chocolate story. If you take that, you get the dark chocolate, over 70% is packed with fiber and polyphenols, and is also likely beneficial in the same way. But it doesn't mean everyone in the US should rush out and fill up with Hershey's, because you're not going to get much fiber and polyphenols from those.
So you're an expert on twins. That's been kind of your one of your scientific focuses. And in fact, you wrote a book about twins a while ago. That is entitled Identically Different. So, you know, this argument, nature versus nurture, you know, you see twins, they're very similar. They're similar in mannerisms, but they're different. So what accounts for, you know, these slight differences? Is it, you know, psychological factors? How much does diet make a difference? Do twins diverge a lot in terms of weight? What insights do we get from studying twins?
Well, twins have been, great, and certainly the best decision I made to study in my career, because you can answer all kinds of questions with the same model. They're the perfect natural experiment. They're equivalent of a laboratory animal study, really, but in real people. And for the first sort of 10 years of my research, really, I was going, wow, isn't that amazing? They're so similar, identical twins compared to non-identical twins. And it's by comparing the two groups that you get these insights. But the last few years, I've been interested in why identical twins who are essentially clones from the same egg, the same environment, often end up very different. And one will be depressed, one will be happy, one might be gay, one might be straight, and sometimes one will be overweight and the other one skinny. And so these really gave you insights that genes alone were not enough to always be sure what was going to happen. And in a way, this is a paradigm for our own lives, that in fact nothing is really preordained, and that we can have propensities to things, but along the way we can change it. And the things that are different between identical twins were something called our epigenetic profiles, which are the ways our genes are switched on and off, a bit like dimmer switches on lights. Mm-hmm. So that we're actually quite different. If you compare identical twins at any one time, the genes can be turned on and off in different ways, so that it's not that similar. And this could explain these major behaviors, by one person will get a heart disease and the other one not, one gets cancer and the other doesn't, and which is actually much more common than people think. Generally, most diseases, you have a less than 50-50 chance of getting it if your identical twin has it. And so the epigenetic changes are quite different, but a more more interestingly, for the point of view of what we're finding now, is that the microbes are very different.
Mm-hmm.
So as well as the way the genes are being turned on and off, the microbes inside, even identical twins, although they're more similar than unrelated people, they're not that similar. And so it's these interactions between our genes and our microbes that probably make these differences and could explain those cases where, you know, one twin is getting fat, the other one's thin, one gets diabetes, the other doesn't. And this tells us a lot about how, even if we're stuck with rather rotten genes, by changing our microbes, which we know we can do through diet now, we can influence those genes epigenetically and have a very different outcome, which I think is a much more optimistic model than people realized just a few years ago.
Can the microbiome influence appetite? Can it actually... can you have a certain composition of bacteria in your intestinal tract that makes you crave, say, sugar or starch or excess calories?
Animal studies have suggested that it is the case. So you can certainly get cravings in laboratory animals and transfer the microbes from that animal into another one who's not being exposed to that food, and they will eat more of that food. So we think it's theoretically possible in humans, although no one has as yet proven it. But it makes sense from a microbe point of view. If you're a microbe that only eats apples,
mm-hmm.
And your survival depends on that, you're going to go through an evolutionary process that's thousands of times faster than a human. You're going to reproduce every half an hour. And occasionally you'll find a mutant that will produce a chemical that just makes that person reach for an apple.
Hmm.
And so the idea is that our microbes have been doing this for millions of years, and they're quite finely tuned. And so increasingly, the people who work on this sort of blood, the brain-gut axis believe that our microbes, whether it's in our mouth or in our guts, are playing a role on appetite and can produce substances that switch off or on our appetite in key ways. So I think increasingly that's looking at a really exciting area to work on, because if you can, in a way, switch the microbes on to say I'm full, that could be a really safe, easy way to deal with obesity.
It's almost like invasion of the body snatchers. It's, we're being commandeered by our microbes to seek out more caloric foods to feed them and perpetuate them at our expense.
Yeah, well, some people have likened us to just a big sack of skin and bones that carries around 4 pounds of microbes, for their lifetime. And that's our role. But it's a two-way process, we keep them alive, we keep their genes going, and they keep our genes going, and there's they can influence, as we said, epigenetically us, but also our genes can also influence them. Mm-hmm. And there's a sort of symbiotic relation. One of the reasons why we're so different to each other is that our gene makeup, our host gene makeup, attracts certain microbes to live in us very specifically. So we have, in a way, we always get the microbiomes we deserve, if you like.
Well, that's a little bit, the analogy is to gardening, which is good gardeners keep healthy, thriving compost heaps, and they really take care of their compost heaps. They don't throw used motor oil on the compost heap because they know that they'll ruin it, or harsh household detergents, because they want to nurture a healthy microbiome, because the microbiome is ultimately going to yield a luxuriant garden. But unfortunately, we as humans have ignored our internal compost heaps and have done, in some cases, irrevocable damage to them.
That's right. I think you've hit the nail on the head there. I think really, the gardening analogy is a great one that and I go into this in the book, that, we should be using this to educate not only ourselves but our kids, everyone really, about the stuff we put in our mouths. it's not just for us. It's, it's feeding this whole community that depends on what goes in. And the wider, the bigger the zoo you've got, the more flowers, the more plants, the more healthy you're going to be, because the more diverse the species, the more diverse the metabolites, and avoiding these toxins and pesticides, and junk foods, artificial chemicals like artificial sweeteners and, emulsifiers, which, also mess us up.
Could you comment on those? Because you actually devote some time in the book to, critiquing artificial sweeteners, because, I mean, it makes sense. You know, they taste sweet. They satisfy our sweet craving. They have zero calories. So, one for one substitution for a caloric sugar, and we should be losing scads and scads of weight. How come that's not working out well?
Turns out that often these, too good to be true, chemicals we come up with are just that. And, they were labeled as safe, and they, probably are in traditional ways of saying things are safe, because they inert. They chemical doesn't affect our, doesn't give us liver cancer, which is all the government cares about in rats, when you give them masses of it. But it interferes with our microbes, because, our body can't digest it. These chemicals that go through that tickle our sweet receptors. But as they go through, the microbes try and digest them, and they partly succeed, but the products they produce from attacking this, all of these artificial chemical sweeteners, has been shown to be rather nasty and produce chemicals that actually make us more likely to be fat and get diabetes. So whilst people are avoiding the calories, the actual chemicals the microbes are producing are slightly counterproductive. Mm-hmm. And this could be why people who have large amounts of diet colas, etc., really don't do very well, and be much better off having water rather than this perfectly safe but a totally artificial drink. So this artificial idea, I think, goes for lots of other things. And there's emulsifiers in all processed foods, in the mayonnaise and tomato ketchup and things. Mm-hmm. And there's obviously pesticides on most modern supermarket foods as well, which are also upsetting our microbes, all of which have been passed as totally safe for humans. So I think we're going to start to need different standards for what we put in our mouths, and inform our governments that actually we should be looking more deeply in these modern inventions that may be cheap and last on the shelves forever, but they have effects somewhere else.
Your organization, the BritishGut.org, has authored a paper about PPIs and the microbiome. PPIs, these powerful acid blockers, Nexium, Prilosec, Prevacid, and its ilk. So many Americans, probably a lot of Brits, are taking acid-blocking medication for heartburn, for GERD, for stomach ulcers. It's, an epidemic. What effect does that have on the microbiome?
Again, this is another example of a drug that was thought to be pretty much perfect. Hardly any side effects. It does a really good job of getting rid of symptoms and reflux. And we didn't think anything more about it. But by studying both our twins and the British Gut Project, which is this crowd-funded project, which is actually a franchise of the American Gut Project, which is started a year or two earlier, we got hundreds of people who were on these drugs and compared them to others, and found that there was a major shift in their microbes. So the numbers didn't change, but basically you were filling up with these particular microbes that liked a different acidity, and they were expanding at the expense of others. So these particular streptococci were having knock-on effects. We don't really know what they are yet, but the microbiome was really distorted in these people. And this was a bit of a shock, because we do know that people who take these drugs are more likely to get infections of the gut, mm-hmm. and suffer from C. difficile infections
and IBS.
This could be why.
And possibly IBS as well.
Yeah, so it could be a whole range of why the immune system or the anti-pathogen efficacy of the gut is being changed in these ways. And, you know, this is very early days. We don't yet know what the long-term consequences are of these drugs. But it just shows that there's no such thing as anything that's totally safe. Once you mess up that garden by putting some magic fertilizer on it that someone tells you is can only do good, there's always going to be a downside.
Indeed. So what's today's intelligent medicine call to action? First of all, the book, The Diet Myth, Why the Secret to Health and Weight Loss is Already in Your Gut, is a fact-filled journey through genetics and the science of the microbiome. It's a great introduction to the subject. I recommend it very highly. It's available from the usual places. Is there a website as well?
There's a website in my name, the Tim Spector website, but there's also the British Gut website and the American Gut website, where you can get information about testing your own microbes. And I think increasingly, as we're not able to do this through any of the regular medical professions or healthcare systems, the public are getting interested in their own guts. And we've now, we've had 2,000 Britons who've signed up. I think there's about 7,000 Americans. So between us, we're getting these very large data sets of what the average gut looks like, what's healthy, what's unhealthy, because I think that's the future, is educating us all on what is normal and baseline, so we can start testing with, in a way, doing our own experiments on ourselves to work out what the best diets are, not only for you, but also what suits your microbes. Mm-hmm. And to do that, you need to study them.
So you could actually undertake the test, perhaps do a diet modification, and then repeat the test to see if you're moving into a more diverse direction. I don't think anybody knows what the perfect combination of microbes is or the ideal combination,
yes,
but at least there are trends.
If you can move. Yeah, this is early days, and at the moment we're just able to do the crude stuff. We can, you know, you can tell if someone's very abnormal, and if they're very, you know, if they look like a normal. And the abnormal ones, you want to see what you're like after a dietary modification and after 3 months. Have you shifted towards the normal? Have you improved your diversity? And that's one of the things that is also key. And so, you know, we believe that's a pretty universal marker of gut health. The more diverse species of microbes or plants in your garden, if you can improve that, then you're onto a good thing.
Okay, well, let's hear it for diversity in all things. It seems to be the buzzword in our culture, as well as in our internal culture, which has a lot to do with how we feel and may have an impact on our susceptibility to weight gain. Congratulations on your phenomenal career, body of work, in elucidating some of these mysteries. And hopefully this is going to point us in a direction that's going to yield tangible benefits.
Yeah, I'm very optimistic.
Thanks a lot. Dr. Tim Spector, author of The Diet Myth, Why the Secret to Health and Weight Loss is Already in Your Gut. I recommend the book very highly. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine Podcast.